We all got on buses, and we went to the pressing plant of Columbia in New Jersey. Was that Pittman?
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to Pittman, and we went to the Victrola Museum in Dover, Delaware. And the bus broke down, as Fred remembers. But I have great memories of that bus trip. And we weren't able to accomplish a field trip in this conference, so we brought the Dover Museum to us, kindly. And James Stewart is an administrator at the Delaware State Museums and has responsibility for the Victrola, the Eldridge Johnson Victrola Museum in Delaware, in Dover, capital. And I'd like to turn the program over to him. Thanks.
Thank you, Sam. There's a bit of trepidation on my part today because I'm probably one of the few non-sound collectors in the room, and I'm speaking to a room of the firmly converted, so have some mercy on us here. You're going to get a view, a little bit of the museum, and also how kind of the museum profession is handling the issue of collecting records and what have you. We also have a special treat today in that we're sharing our session with a film firm called Teleduction, and they are working on a video on Eldridge Reeves Johnson for a documentary. Right now, due to funding problems, they only have it at a half hour. But you're going to get to see a trailer which shows you some of the work. And also, you'll get to see some of the visuals of some of the things that you can see in the museum. Now, just for those of you who don't know, Dover, Delaware is about an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on the traffic from here, and going down I-95 south and then Route 1 into Dover. The Johnson Victrola Museum is part of the Delaware State Museum system. We have 8 museums in total, so obviously we can't spend all of our attention and time on that. But we have been spending a lot of time over the last, since 1988, when I took over as administrator, we've been putting a lot of emphasis on the museum and its collection. It was founded by E.R. Fenimore Johnson in 1964, and it opened in 1967. Fenimore Johnson was the son of E.R. Johnson, the founder of the Victor Talking Machine Company, and Fenimore himself served on the board and was a vice president of Victor up until the time of the RCA acquisition, and he gets out shortly thereafter. He funded the museum building and gave the initial collection, and he also endowed it, which is what we've been operating off of since then. We have a small endowment which pays us quarterly, and we have been collecting as we go along. We remain true to his vision of it being a museum about the Victor Talking Machine Company and E.R. Johnson. It is not, at their insistence, a phonograph museum. We amended the trust agreement by negotiating with the grandchildren over the last few years. Because after about 40 years, the trust agreement itself, which was to some degree a flow of consciousness by Fenimore Johnson on his part, reflecting his interest, what he thought was collectible, much to the horror of collectors today. He wasn't very interested in the electric phonographs. That's now changed in the last 40 years. And it was a little too restrictive for us as far as displays and doing some things internal to the museum. So by talking to the Johnson family, they signed a letter of agreement, and it allows us to expand out a little bit. First off, we now market it as the Johnson Victrola Museum because we could not market the Eldridge Reeves Johnson Memorial to save our neck. Many people nowadays don't know who Eldridge Reeves Johnson was. We call the building the Eldridge Reeves Johnson Memorial, but we had to change for marketing purposes, and they fully understood and have agreed to it. We can, as per the original agreement, we can collect phonographs, et cetera, that reflect the early development of the industry up to the time that Victor's established, so up to about 1901 or so. That has allowed us to pick up a lot of very early phonographs, a lot of early materials. We acquired a very large collection the Linwood Hygis was his name, is a collector out of Rockville, Maryland, and we acquired a large collection about 5-6 years ago now. And it had over 215 phonographs. I think the museum had 90 at the time, so it was literally the little guy bought the big guy. For your interest, I think he had 10 or 12,000 records. John Bolig in the back is very familiar with that collection and can tell you more about it than I can. And that collection really started to put us on the map. It has taken us since then a lot of time just to try to get this thing organized, to comprehend what we really have, look at the duplication within the collection, look at the duplication between that collection and ours. The two collections are now fully integrated. It's one. And so that gave us that big push. We can also collect a representative samples of the competitors' products, such as Columbia, Brunswick, or whoever, that put Victor in context with a special emphasis on the fact that Victor often was not necessarily the guy who innovated. Victor sometimes followed. Columbia as an example with the two-sided record. Much to Mr. Johnson's dismay, they were giving double the product for the same price. He just didn't like that at all. And so we can collect items that make Victor react. And we do have a certain amount of material, particularly when we picked up the Hyges collection, we have a certain amount of material that has come in that is related to the other companies, Edison, Sonora, what have you. We don't aggressively, actively collect it anymore. We are picking up representative samples of machines and some signs for display purposes. Remember, as a museum, that's our business. The way we tend to express ourselves most of the time is through collections, artifacts, and exhibits. Then as a secondary manner, we do it through programs and publications. Or in many cases, we're helping others when they do their programs and publications. Recently, in the last year, those of you who know George, Paul, and Tim Fabrizio, they have come down on their, was that their seventh book now, I think they're working on. I had the joy of hosting the Deadly Duo for part of a weekend, and as they did their work and they found a lot of items down there that they wanted to photograph for their next book, and we probably only got through about half of what they wanted to do, so at some point in the next year or so, my guess is we'll see them again. We have been very lucky over the years through people like Bob Bombach, the author of Look for the Dog. Yes, thank you. A little brain drain there. Kurt Nauck has been extremely generous with his knowledge on records. John Bolig has been very generous early years on with the collection. We have gained a lot of knowledge through that. Part of the purpose of today's discussion by myself is to alert you guys that the museum is there and alive and well. In the 1970s and early 80s, due to the economic problems that the state of Delaware faced, they literally at one point were within range of going bankrupt, so the state really jammed on the brakes, and the museum went to sleep. It really lost momentum. It went off the collecting market to a fair degree. A lot of the people, some of those of you who have been around for a long time, I know with Fred and some others, they just lost contact with it completely. We had one staff member who wanted to be here today but could not, Ann Horsey, our curator of collections. And for, I'd say, probably about 10 years, she was kind of the lone voice in the wilderness as an internal advocate for that museum. And then once we got to looking at things after I took over, I realized we had really had something very unique. My background is in business history anyway, so obviously I had an interest, and I happen to like advertising, so gee, a Victor Museum, I mean, there's not much advertising there, so certainly that drew my interest. And so since then, we have been putting a tremendous amount of effort for us into this. We've been going out to the shows, and we've been building it up. I'm going to go through the whole thing, and I saved the record collection for last, because I know there's going to be some interest there. With the paper collection, we are really trying to complete a complete run of all the record catalogs and music promotional materials of Victor. That is a huge challenge. We are well on our way. We've had people, in fact, I see several familiar faces in the room, people who with their own project interests have come in looking for things, and they have been able to tell us information on some of the stuff that we're seeing in the catalogs that we don't fully know who these people are or what the background is behind them. We're also very interested in all the materials related to the marketing of and by Victor and its distributors and dealers. This is a very interesting situation. The more we're working with this, the more we're learning. Victor promoted. Victor produced material for the distributors and the dealers to promote. The distributors and distributors produced material for the dealers to promote, and then the dealers themselves promoted. So you have three and four levels of promotion going on simultaneously. And so the volume of stuff is just huge. And it's relentless. Victor just keeps pounding away at people in their marketing. And I think they are probably properly credited with a big help towards the popularization of recorded music and what have you. They're very good at the whole thing of calling their phonographs instruments because they're trying to compare it to, particularly in the early times, they're trying to compare it to people who were thinking about having the piano and how you uplift the morality of the home and the kids and the whole nine yards. So Victor rides right on that. And just watching how they work, and we have only scratched the surface on that, is really something. We are attempting to acquire a complete collection of the dealer magazine, The Voice of the Victor. We are working with a couple people right now, and we're getting reproductions of a lot of the issues. Because the Victor Archives was scattered by General Electric, it's not out there intact anywhere, although we're beginning to find out where some chunks of it are. We are trying to, Voice of the Victors is critically important in the sense that you have Victor talking to you using its marketing voice in the present tense. It's almost as important when you read The Voice of the Victor to look at what they don't say as what they do say. So in the 1920s and the early 20s, you do not find reference one to the fact that they go through a bloodletting in their distributors where between 21 and 25, over half of them are gone. There's a shift in the industry. It's much more competitive. There are failure to pick up on radio and a couple other issues. I don't completely know why this is happening. We had become aware of it. Then I found an article in the Talk Machine Journal, and it talks about they go from 86 to 43 in 4 years. And so there's some issues there. Now, if you look in the Voice of the Victor, you aren't going to see this. So as you know more outside facts, then you start watching what they're saying internally, what they're saying, when they're saying it. We're also very active in the collecting of magazine ads. We have several people who have been acting as sources for us. We now have 1,680 Victor magazine ads and 1,290 non-magazine ads. Many of them, for those of you who are collectors of music and dealing with issues along those lines, a lot of these things obviously promote the artist. So there's some interesting things there that you can see. The museum under Ann Horsey did a correspondence swap with EMI in England. And what we did was is we gave them Victor's side of the correspondence that we had, and they gave us the, was that gramophone and typewriter, GNT side of things from the other end. So you have both ends of the correspondence. Now, I've looked at some of that correspondence. A lot of that is as well you have to adjust the left-handed flangel on the tone arm or whatever. There's a lot of it's fairly mundane. There's a lot of issues of parts are getting rusted because they're sitting in the holds of ship and there's water sloshing around in there. And so, you know, a lot of the nitty-gritty that was very important at the time but makes somewhat less than wonderful reading today. But there's probably, who knows what's in there for other folks. It's something that, you know, people are going to have to come down there and look at these things for their own purposes. We've also been collecting a certain degree of paper over the last 5 years or so whereby we're picking up paper on how not only Victor operated but some of their competitors. You'll find little bits and pieces, particularly on eBay, of, you know, contracts, how they're dealing with some of their dealers, what they're saying, some of their pricing practices. We have to remember as a museum, and the Johnsons fully agree, even though we are the Victor Talking Machine Company Museum, they didn't operate in a vacuum. We have to put them in context. That's very important for us to do that. And so they have very generously agreed on the paper side to allow us to do that as long as we keep the museum focused on E.R. Johnson and the Victor Talking Machine Company. We have within the last 3 years, I guess it is, maybe it's two now, several of you were down there, we were able to clear the second floor of the museum, which had been converted into storage for other things, and we now have an entire new gallery on the second floor. So if you haven't been down to the Johnson Petroleum Museum in the last 5 years or so, it's very different. And it is completely expanded. I'll brag on the exhibit staff. I didn't do it. They did. But they did just a wonderful job. We have it set up in such a way that we can change sections of the gallery so we don't have to do the entire floor at once, because for a small organization like ourselves, to do an entire gallery of that size is pretty intense task and wouldn't happen very often. And those of you who have been down there know that it tended to be an open storage facility. It didn't change all that much. We're trying to address that issue. We are currently investigating at this time preliminary architectural drawings and plans, and our goal is to expand the museum again. We need to do it because for years we were blocked by the fact that our parking lot happened to be an old coal gasification plant site, and our parking lot was actually a Superfund site. So we've been dealing with the EPA, and you're really thrilled when the Army Corps of Engineers is managing a project for the EPA. I didn't think I'd live so long as to see that project done, but lo and behold, it did indeed happen. We have a lovely new paved parking lot, so your car won't get bogged down when you pull into the lot. And so we have some things that are going on there. But when the EPA completed their project and the Superfund site issues went away, we immediately became vulnerable to the issues of handicapped accessibility. If you put any serious money into a facility in this day and age, you have to address the accessibility issues. For years, we couldn't because of the EPA. So all we did was swap one single-issue federal bureaucracy for another single-issue federal bureaucracy. I've decided to use that as the hammer with state government to push the expansion of the building. We should gain store space, restrooms up on the first floor, elevators so people to the second floor, additional gallery space, because we can't dig down into the ground, we have been using the tower on the cabinet factory in Camden, and we'd like to have a small tower that echoes or suggests the building in Camden, New Jersey. It's not a replica by any means, certainly considerably smaller and shorter, but with an elevator, you have to have a 4.5 to 5 foot clearance above or below whatever it is that you're doing, so we needed to build a tower. So once they said, you got to build a tower, I said, have I got a tower for you? And so they have been working on that along those lines for a while now. So we're pushing towards that. But obviously right now, with the economy being as bad as it is, and with state governments really hurting, Delaware is like a lot of states. I wouldn't be surprised if they disengage from being connected, linked to the federal income tax thing. Times are very tight. So things have slowed down, but we have been allowed to do the preliminary planning, and we're working on that now, and with a little patience, and we took us 18 years, but we got the EPA out of the way, we will get this out of the way, and we will have ourselves a very interesting collection. We have collected quite a bit along the way of what Victor called the trades helps, or sales helps, or dealers helps, signs, nippers, voice of the book of the opera, the things for music in the schools, pillows, all kinds of things. The metal signs, they had designs for billboards. They called it decalomania. And you could come up with a design. They had a design for billboards, and you could have a decal made and put on your billboard. Thus, you didn't have to have it hand-painted, thus saving yourself money on this. All the little premiums that they would give away, the publications that they did. I think we have a full run of the Book of the Opera now. I'm looking at Claudia Melson, who's back in the back there, and Deborah Sellers, two of our staff members, are here today. There is still a tremendous amount of that that's floating around out there, and we're using the voice of the Victor to tell us. We're going to have an inventory of what Victor was telling everybody was out there in that world. I'm not sure it's fully known. Ruth Edge's book, I think, does it fairly well, but Ruth Edge's book has obviously got an English spin to it, so we have to pay attention to what's going on in the U.S., we're going to try to define to some degree what the universe is on these trades helps, and then try to pick up one of each, or at least find out where they are and have pictures of them. So there's some interesting projects going on out there. As you can see with this, we are facing some pretty interesting challenges in the sense that I'm sitting here speaking today to the sound recording people. You're all very interested in the records. But the machines don't mean a whole lot to many of the people in this room. When I go to the phonograph shows, they're very interested in the machines and can tell me down to the left flange nut about some subtle change in some model, what have you, but they really don't care about the records. The paper people don't give a darn about machines or records. Then you have the nipper nuts out there on the other edge. Yeah, and and then you have the advertising people as well. So there is an interesting set of people that we get to deal with. As I like to tell people, I said we deal with various forms of kind of socially acceptable insanity, and that there is an interesting groups out there, and they're all very, very passionate, as you are, about their specific area of interest and knowledge. And as a trained historian, the thing that fascinates me the most is that it is the collectors, the enthusiasts, the collector dealers, the amateurs who have saved, really, and preserved and are now laying it out to a fair degree, have saved the history of American recorded sound, both in the manufacturing side, on the music side. Institutions like the Library of Congress and the rest of us, we're gathering this stuff in, to the credit of everybody, you're seeing the publications coming out. And that is just absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful thing, and keep on doing it. And Mr. Spotswood, wherever you are, we loved your book when we were working on some of our collections, and we'll be looking for that other one, I guess, fairly soon. That is something that is just tremendously important, and we encourage all of you to do, is to share the knowledge. The number of folks that have been incredibly generous with us with their knowledge, we return that favor. We don't hoard information. If we know you're interested, we'll be glad to share. We recently lost an auction on eBay, and a fellow in Germany picked up a 1907 document dealing with the history of Victor. And he transcribed the entire thing to us and sent it to us because he wasn't sure of the context. So we then kicked it to Bob Bombach and Ray Weil, and I believe eventually Steve Smullyans should be getting one. I don't think it ever left my office. I think Steve's copy's on my desk. And we're very interested in what the context is, and we'll provide that for him as he's going on towards whatever his interests are. And Ray, obviously, as the legal historian of a lot of the phonograph industry, has really got the jump on this. Unfortunately, he's recovering from a broken hip, so he can't get downstairs where most of his material is, so there is somewhat of a delay. But just Ray's memory knowledge is phenomenal. And so we're beginning to get a much stronger view of what this thing comes from, because it lays it out chapter and verse from a legal view. It's clear that this is a legal document. They're laying out chapter and verse of the legal history and the various perambulations that were going on in Victor up through 1907. We think it has to do something to do with the Berliner interests and consolidated, and there were two consolidated companies, and we could spend 3 hours just talking about that, and I'm not the guy to do that. But that's just an example of how we do share information with other folks, and we go from there. One of the most recent additions to the collection, I guess the next thing I would talk about is our record collection. We manage our collection, we kind of shamelessly stole the Canadian National Library system of three categories. After doing a lot of phone conversations, talking to a lot of folks, we kind of decided that what we'll do is we would break it down into three primary categories. The archival collection, which is our best or only copy. The latest census on that is 19,753 records. Now, this is not large by comparison to the major sound archives around the country. But just remember, it's 19,753 Victor records. It's very concentrated in one area. So we're small, but it is a very strong and a very focused collection. The archival, the duplicate collection, which is basically what we say it is basically everything that's duplicate. We have it on display in the museum, in the record shop display, and the guides can play any record they wanted on it. We have 23,420 of them, and I believe several people have said that at least 22,000 of them are taking me back to old Virginia, but I'm not sure. we haven't done a full census on that one yet. The museum had evolved backwards for some reason over the years. It had evolved with the archival collection out front where the public could get at it, and the duplicate collection was in the back locked up. And I suspect it just started that way, and as you know with records, once it's kind of like where the 900-pound elephant sleeps. Once it gets there, it stays there. We finally had the space and the flexibility, and we moved the collections around to make them to the point that it's rational. So now you can look at the archival collection and not have the fourth grade going through at the same time while you're doing it, which makes for a better research experience, I think. The exchange collection are the items that came with, as you know, when you acquire a collection, you want some part of it, but you're taking all this other stuff along with it. We don't have a lot of that right now. We've done two trades within the last 10 years. We shipped a large amount, probably close to 13,000 records to a collector in Japan in a tripartite deal about 10 years ago. And then a more recent acquisition, we ended up sending a large collection down to North Texas State University, which is in the process of forming a sound record archives. Our latest acquisition is probably the source of some heartache. I'm looking at Fred over here. He's growling at me. There's a source of some heartache for the local Philadelphia collector community because the Philadelphia Free Library was pressed for space, facing a lot of mission issues like municipal governments are even worse shape than city governments. They had a problem, and they decided that they needed to move their record collection out. Now, to their credit, what they did was, and this is the same responsibility goes to libraries, archives, and museums, if you decide to move a collection out, your first priority mission is to find it an appropriate and good home. And so what happened was is that they sent us, or we went up and got, it was god-awful hot last summer when Claudia, Debbie, and I went up there. I think we went up 4 or 5 weeks in a row in a minivan and just jammed them full of records, and Debbie's still going through them as we speak. We picked up close to 8,000 Victor records, which Victor had sent across the river to the Philadelphia Free Library. Now, this is a very excellent example of how an institution is protecting itself and also at the same time protecting its overarching mission, which all professionals share, which is find these collections a good home if you're not it. One of the features of this collection was 4,338 ethnic records. And after a year, we're down to about 550 or so that Debbie has not gotten through. She's figuring by maybe mid-August or so, she will have gone through this and we'll have it inventoried. In the handout, there's a breakdown that's based on the labels themselves. We are not music experts by any shape, form of imagination. but this gives you a little bit of an example of the breakdowns. It's based on Victor's labels. So the fact that there's Hebrew and Jewish and Yiddish or Serbo-Croat and Croatian-Serbo, I don't know why they were doing that division. We can't explain that. All we can tell you is right now is how many we have. This collection turned out to be almost a custom fit. Out of all the records that have been coming in, we found less than 200 duplicates. You almost never find that kind of a match. We were extremely weak in the ethnic records. We aren't anymore. Now, I don't know what the full universe of Victor's ethnic record production is, but obviously picking up 4,300 puts us a long way in that direction. Some very interesting stuff is in there. We've been getting a few people have started to come in and ask us about some of it. Our goal in the next 5 years, hopefully with a little luck, we will have the record inventory on our website. We do not right now. So that at least some of these questions can be answered. You can go on, look at the music, see if we've got what it is you think you're interested in without having to call us. You can do it anytime you want. Obviously, it takes a certain burden off of us also. We're very short staffed these days. This kind of gives you a brief idea of where we are with the museum. This is a very unique museum, and I'm not bragging about that. When we went to do the second floor displays, we searched the country by professional contacts, conferences, websites, professional journals, because we were trying to find somebody to compare ourselves to, and we really couldn't. The only thing we could come up with was the Country Music Hall of Fame. And so what we found was is that to have a recorded sound museum dedicated to one company established at this level of progress towards having the whole story, the Johnson Victrola Museum may be one of a kind, certainly fairly rare. Which is one of the reasons why we've been pushing it, because a state museum system, to certain degrees, are regional differences, but a state museum is a state museum is a state museum. So this is one thing that we can kind of show as our crown jewel, as something that is unique to Delaware State Museum System. We're very proud of our other seven museums, and they each have unique qualities to them. But obviously, this is something that even the international visitors love. We can, the development office will frequently bring Japanese tour groups through. They're very polite at the old State House. They're very polite at the John Dickinson Plantation, signer of the Declaration of Independence, and a big party to the writing of the Constitution. But their eyes light up when they get in the Johnson Victrola Museum, because they know Japan Victor Corporation, JVC. They can relate to that. And you can just watch them become more animated, because, in fact, we've even had a Japanese television firm investigate the possibility of using us for some documentary. They've not come back, so I don't know what happened. But it just shows you that the appeal tends to be international. I don't have to tell you guys that music's appeal crosses national borders. We've got an audience there that may be fairly unique. We've been assisting some people. We're not a true sound archives in the sense of the Library of Congress or what have you, but we have been assisting some people with some projects as we can. We're somewhat limited in our response, but those of you who know Ward Marston, and he did that CD with the 1912 election campaign debates, I believe it was Taft and Roosevelt and I'm not sure who else. Wilson? Yes, Wilson. We helped with that, and I think we even provided a poster which helped with some of the visuals for it. The Maud Powell Society has been contacting us. I believe they might be working with Ward on a CD, if I remember right. There's probably people, somebody's over there nodding their head. So I know we've been in contact. I think we've loaned some things to them, and we've done some things to try to help that project along. We are extremely limited in our ability to respond. I suggest you go to our website and check us out. And I better pull my card because I don't know my website because it's already on my web thing anyway, which will be www.destatemuseums.org. In there you'll find links to the Johnson Victrola Museum, and there is also an inquiry link which ends up coming across my computer, and then I route them to the various staff members. The more focused you are on your inquiry, the more likely we are to be able to help you. We are not staffed or equipped right now to handle fishing expeditions. So you need to be fairly focused on what your interest is so that we can come to you and ask. And more than likely, in many of these subjects, you're going to know far more about them than we are. Remember, we're a museum. So these, to some degree, we look at these records as artifacts. 10,000 records, 2,200 nippers, 57 machines. You know, to some degree, we're not quite that basic level, but we look at it very differently than many of you would. Your level of interest and your level of knowledge is going to be greater than ours because we're generalists in a field that's full of specialists. And so you can help us quite a bit. I think at this point, what I'd like to do is bring up Sharon Baker from Teleductions. And Teleductions was working with us, and they're working on a documentary on E.R. Johnson. Right now, it's limited to a half-hour film due to funding issues. They dearly love, and so would we, to have it be expanded to a full hour. So I'd like you, they have a trailer, and it also gives you visuals of the movie, so I'd like to turn it over to Sharon. Sharon?
Morning. This is a complete non sequitur, but I was listening to the most wonderful old radio recordings today in honor of Bob Hope's 100th birthday. And I don't know, I just sort of had to mention that. Maybe he's up there shining down. My name is Sharon Baker. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Dan Collins. He is, I know, but the others, Kay Kaiser and some of the old guys that he worked with. This is my colleague, Dan Collins, who did the lion's share of the writing and the research on the project. We are independent filmmakers. Most of the work that you've seen that we've produced has been on public broadcasting, although some has been on A&E and Bravo and so forth. We deal with historic subjects, and we thought ourselves extremely blessed to have found the E.R. Johnson Victrola Museum in Dover, and to learn that although Thomas Edison and others are a household word, E.R. Johnson, you know, nobody sort of turns their head. And as an independent organization, one of the few advantages you have is finding unique access to a new story. And while the story might be very familiar, of course, to this audience, to the general public, E.R. Johnson is kind of an unknown, I'd say. So in working with Jim and Claudia and his wonderful staff, we have set about producing an hour-long documentary on the life and work of E.R. Johnson. And this was for American Public Television and for TVF International, our distributor abroad, who also wanted the program. And we're still going to distribute it, but midway in the project, the economy took a nosedive, and funding sort of tightened down for projects that are of a more, I would say, historical and entertainment nature. So Dan Collins, who did the lion's share of the research and writing, has done a, I think, wonderful job scaling the project back to 30 minutes. It will still be distributed free of charge to regional public broadcasting. There will be a wonderful companion website that is ready to go that will link to museums where we put all of the extra information that we have uncovered in the last year and a half, maybe a little more, in working on the project. But if anyone here would like to step up to the plate and sponsor the program, we'll be happy to sort of expand it back out to an hour for international broadcast. We do have a 501c3, so if anyone does have a foundation or know of anyone that has a foundation and would like to participate, we'd be very happy to talk with you. So this is a clip. It's for a general consuming audience, including students, because we version everything we do for high school and college students, and we hope you like it. Want to add anything here? Okay. Yep.
Music on demand, whenever, wherever, and in almost whatever format we want, is an everyday part of 21st century life.
This is a Berliner gramophone disc from 1889. And this is a Deutsche gramophone disc from 1989.
Revenue from the global music market is expected to top $60 billion and continue to climb. Fast-paced, hyper-competitive, dominated by endless legal battles, that's life in the recording industry. And it's been going on for more than 100 years, thanks in large part to the innovations of Eldridge R. Johnson.
Something that's completely lost in any understanding of technology development is that extraordinarily difficult second phase of innovation to move products forward.
He was willing to take the risk because at that time, the idea of branding, all that's really new stuff.
Thomas Alva Edison proved that sound could be mechanically reproduced in 1877 while perfecting a voice-capturing device for long-distance telephone at his Menlo Park, New Jersey laboratory. Rough and imperfect though it was, the tinfoil phonograph would change history and spark fierce competition among his rivals. Soon after, Alexander Graham Bell commissioned his cousin Chichester and engineer Charles Sumner Tainter to upstage the Wizard of Menlo Park. Their graphophone, released in 1886, recorded on wax instead of tinfoil and was far superior in sound quality. But despite the publicity generated by the inventions, the public saw the speaking machines as little more than novelties. Soon enough, however, all of that would change. Eldridge Reeves Johnson was born on February 6, 1867 in Wilmington, Delaware. After his mother Caroline died, Eldridge spent much of his childhood with his great aunt Elizabeth.
When he was growing up, he saw a tinfoil phonograph. And when he was about 10, 11 years old, was entranced with the idea that sound could be captured in tinfoil.
He graduated from the Dover Academy in 1882. But his teachers discouraged him from seeking further education, and he opted to take an industrial job instead.
He wasn't in the beginning very enthusiastic about being apprenticed to a machinist. But on the other hand, he wasn't a particularly good student, and so that's why he was eventually sent to Philadelphia.
After 4 hard years as an apprentice, Johnson took a position at the Standard Machine Shop on the waterfront in Camden, New Jersey. The work was grueling and thankless, but he was determined to rise from the ranks to become a gentleman. By 1894, Johnson purchased his employer's interest in the shop and immediately changed the name to Eldridge R. Johnson Manufacturing Company. He was now a business owner, but the status afforded him little luxury.
The sacrifices that I made in the early stages of my career for the purpose of being my own boss were more than I would care to be forced to repeat. We had hard times, and plenty of them.
Then, an event occurred that would change Johnson's future altogether. Without it, he later insisted, his life and the history of the recording industry would have been entirely different. While Johnson was beginning his work as a machinist, German-born inventor Emil Berliner began to make improvements in sound recording that would revolutionize the industry. Berliner determined that the recording process used by the cylinder machines was fundamentally flawed. Berliner found that sound waves captured in a lateral motion resulted in higher quality sound. He also replaced the standard cylinder with a flat circular disc.
The big advantage to the disc over cylinder was that you could stamp them out instead of having to make them more or less one or a few at a time.
Up until that time, they were all dubs. You made one recording, you put it on a player, and to make copies, you just dubbed it from one machine to another.
Berliner developed an acid etching process that created a master disc from an original wax recording, allowing for easy reproduction. Though quantities were limited to the life of the master copy, the development signaled the beginning of the music entertainment industry. Introduced in 1887, Berliner's disc-playing gramophone, the first of its kind, was heralded as a great scientific achievement. But it still lacked a critical element that severely limited its marketing potential.
The problem with the gramophone was that you had to keep cranking it in order to play the record. And of course, you never knew if you were cranking it at the proper speed. But at any rate, Eldridge Johnson came along and solved that very, very serious problem.
Berliner's search for a spring-powered motor to drive the gramophone soon led him to Johnson. In February 1896, he sent representatives to the small machine shop with a gramophone in hand, in search of a viable design. Johnson was transfixed.
The little instrument was badly designed. It sounded much like a partially educated parrot with a sore throat and a cold in the head. But the little wheezy instrument caught my attention and held it fast and hard. I became interested in it as I have never been interested in anything before. It was a great opportunity, and it came to me as it can never come to any other man in the talking machine business again.
Johnson set to work and quickly developed a spring-loading motor that ran at a constant speed, was affordable, and worked quietly, making the hand-cranked gramophones obsolete.
Something that's completely lost in any understanding of technology development is that extraordinarily difficult second phase of innovation to move products forward. And this man took a lousy laboratory model and turned it into a marketable product. He does all the hard work to make the machine and to make the sound recording process a worthwhile long-term venture.
Recognize someone else's cameo appearance in there. So that's a sneak preview, and if you like that, I think you'll really like the half hour, and we hope it will open the subject matter up to a whole new group of people, a whole new generation of students. And Steve Smolian's here. He's one of our stars. In the hour-long version, we were coming all the way up through EMI, and we went to Great Britain a year ago and did a wonderful interview with Rupert Perry. And we're really, you know, going more into the EMI sort of history as well. But I suspect, in fact, I know, that we really kind of, you know, have an all Johnson all the time focus on the shorter version. Dan Collins, I have to give you a round of applause because Dan is channeling E.R. Johnson at this point. You know, he's been so close to the subject, and it wasn't an easy task to sort of whittle all that 1 hour back to a half hour. So we look forward to getting it out in the next couple of weeks, and hopefully Jim will have a big splashy premiere, and then it'll be on a website. So thank you so much.
A minute while we change equipment, but we're a little behind. You have a question, Fred?
Yeah, I'd like to add to what Jim said. Since I've been involved with this thing for 10 years, that is the acquisition of the significant, the incredible collection of ethnic music. 10 years ago, I was asked by the Free Library to come in and take an inventory, which I did. I didn't go through the Red Seal records with the fine-tooth comb that I did with the ethnics. And at that time, I made a recommendation that it go to the Fenimore Johnson Museum. But what happened in the interim is that the Balch Institute of Ethnic Studies became a factor in Philadelphia. And then, a couple of years ago, the Balch Institute was taken over by the Pennsylvania Historical Society. Knowing that the Victor Company, or surmising that the Victor Company had sent those records across the river, and probably the only set of its kind, and I don't know that for a fact, but an incredible set, because it was Philadelphia, I felt, I alone came to this conclusion, that this is something that the Victor Company bequeathed to Philadelphia, and therefore that it should stay here. But I have never been opposed to it going down to Jim's bailiwick, because it needs to be in a place where it's taken care of. More than that, in examining all of these black label records, I never found a spindle hole mark, never mind a drop needle, out of all those thousands of records. And it is truly remarkable. I have done the research on how many were made of each copy, because my many years spending a week a year from 53 to 86 at the Victor Company, both Philly and twice in two different locations in New York. And I found out that many of these things were anywhere from about 200 copies up to about 1,500 to 2,000. That's a generalization. So that they're super, super rare. And it ties in with the trip around South America that the Victor Company made in 1917. Mercifully, I have Xeroxed the copy of that book, and it's a story that needs to be told. But I want you to understand some perspective. I had no involvement with the Red Seals and none with the other types of records. That is interest in making any recommendation. But that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Sam?
Yeah.
Please,
yeah.
Just to give the people the final, those that don't know about it, last Saturday was the opening of the rental office for what is now the Victor Loft Apartments, which is the shell of the building, which are now luxury apartments, and the tower that everybody's familiar with that has Nipper on top is a three-story health club. So if anybody wants to see the brochure, I have one that they can stop and see me, and I'll show it to you. I may have
great photographs on the web. It shows the building and the shell of the building. Right. Great pictures.
Okay, thank you. I have two quick announcements. First of all, I was incorrect about the web access. You have to be a Penn student. I told you you had to pay the tuition to get it. I knew that would... Now it's back.